Attention, troops! This is Sergeant Gerard. This is no pussy-ass detail. This is They Came From The North. Your podcast about all things Canadians and directors. Are you here, Private Mercer?
Put your mouth on this.
Private Power.
Strap this on your sore-ass plane.
You better tuck your asses in, because this week visiting us, we have General Contrarian Dan Mancini.
The only thing that can kill Barnes is Barnes.
And we will be tackling director Oliver Stone. Oliver Stone was born in 1946 in New York City. The son of a stockbroker. He did a lot of jobs as a young kid, amongst them staying in Paris and working for the Mercantile Exchange. Tried to go into Yale University twice and dropped out both times. Once to teach high school students in Vietnam and then to enlist in the army to go in Vietnam. He went to in Vietnam from September 67 to November 68 with the 25th Infantry Division, earning a Bronze Star with Combat V and a Purple Heart with an oak leaf cluster. And he has also participated in more than 25 helicopter combat assaults. Stone graduated from film school at New York University in 71. Martin Scorsese was one of his teachers. And in 74, he made his first movie, the horror film Seizure, very rarely seen and not released on DVD. And then he wrote the script for Midnight Express in 78, which garnered him an Oscar. And in 81, he directed the horror movie The Hand, starring Michael Caine. Then he took a long break, working mostly on script writing, co-writing Conan the Barbarian with John Milius, Scarface for Brian De Palma, co-writing Year of the Dragon with Michael Cimino, and then came back strong in 1986 with the movie Salvador, which garnered him again lots of attention for its political focus and the acting of James Woods. In 1986, he would get his biggest success up to date, Platoon, which would win the Academy Award for the best movie. In 1987, he attacked the Wall Street people with the movie Wall Street, inspired both by his father and by his own experience working for trade companies. In 1988, the trash radio expose, talk radio, based on an Eric Bogosian play. 1989, another Vietnam movie, Born on the 4th of July, starring Tom Cruise, who wasn't really recognized as an actor back there, mostly as a big star with the action movies. And Born on the 4th of July will again be nominated for many awards and garner the Academy Award for Best Director. In 1991, he put the Doors back on the map with his movie starring Val Kilmer as Jim Morrison. 1991, again, his most controversial and most discussed movies probably up to date, JFK, about the investigation behind the JFK assassination. 1993, Heaven and Earth, about the romance between a Vietnamese girl and an American resident. 1994, another very controversial movie, as if he hadn't had enough of that with JFK, the very violent media pilfering Natural Born Killers. In 1995, yet another portrait of President Nixon with Anthony Hopkins in an unlikely turn as a disgraced president. In 1997, the noir road movie black comedy U-Turn. 1999, the football movie Any Given Sunday, a really big commercial success, which then gave him leeway to do his biggest movie, his biggest budgeted movie, Alexander, which was unfortunately a slop for Stone. But then in retaliated with very current events in 2006, World Trade Center, mostly about the firefighters who got people out of the WTC. In 2008, about then President of the United States, George W. Bush, was due for re-election. In 2010, The Wall Street sequel, Money Never Sleeps, and most recent movie, 2012, Savages. So let's buckle down, let's go down the labyrinth road to the Zapruder film and not get and see very bombastic filmmaking from the always interesting and very American filmmaker, Mr. Oliver Stone, who wants to go for his good, bad, and ugly. So
I am not.
Who's on first?
Well, actually, seeing as we have a guest present, I think we should let Dan go first.
All right. I am a contrarian, so I'll warn you of that up front. I think the obvious choice for good is Platoon. I would say that is his – I don't know if it's his most famous movie, but I think it's his most respected, and I think for good reason. It is a really great movie. That's why I'm not going to pick it, though. I'm assuming someone else will. I want to throw that caveat out there because otherwise my actual choice looks insane if I don't say that up front. I'm going to go in terms of good with Any Given Sunday.
Wow.
Let me just step in and say, Dan, I love your choice as good.
Very good. Thank you. It's not a perfect film. I find it a very strange film because of the way that Stone delves into sports movie cliche. I mean, he dives in with both feet, especially in the third act of that movie where kind of everything hits at once. And he's doing it on purpose. I mean, it's almost satire where you have the aging quarterback versus the young quarterback, the dude who may die on field, the coach whose job's on the line and has to either make a risky call or a safe call, all that stuff that we're used to in sports movies. And I just love the movie every time I see it. If it's on TV, it's one of those movies where I will stop and watch the whole thing. I think it's got Pacino in full-on late career screaming mode, but it's the right context for that. It actually works. It's the movie more than any other, I think, that makes great use of Jamie Foxx's long-standing love affair with himself. And it's just a blast, I think. You know, I don't know that the third act of the film really works entirely, but I still love it. And I love sports. I love baseball. I love football. I almost always hate baseball and football movies, even the ones that are beloved. I hate Field of Dreams. I hate Rudy. Most sports movies like that because they're just so sappy and so saccharine. And Stone avoids that. It's not a sentimental movie. It's a movie that gets to football as a sport and football as a business. And I've just always dug it.
I would love to say, though, even though it's not a sentimental movie, it always brings a tear to my eye in the scene when Lawrence Taylor dives into a vat of crack cocaine and chainsaws a car in half.
Yes. Yeah.
I
think
love
that idea was originally in Rudy. They cut it out and then Stone picked it up.
I think LT pulls it off much better than Sean Astin could ever hope to have done.
One thing I really loved about Any Given Sunday, I love the energy on the field.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way he films the game sequences, it's, you know, like not to use a cliche. Okay, no, I will use a cliche. It's football like you've never seen football. You know,
it's filmed
it's
like a war movie,
man.
Yeah, or a war movie.
There's one particular, and I'm not even a fan of the song, but one of the particular scenes that he showed always in the trailer, the set to Baba to Baba by Kid Rock.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a great, great scene. Ends with a really cool, this was the money shot, the trailer, the slow-mo of Pacino screaming.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. Of course. Which he does so well.
And yeah, Pacino was great.
In the 1980s onward.
I loved Quaid in this movie too, actually.
Yeah.
as Captain America.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, just as a straight up, like, entertaining film, this might be the most entertaining movie Stone has made, you know, just all the way through. And that can reach, like, to a lot of people.
It's like, right up there for me. Yeah, Stone, his body of work in general are movies. There's a few exceptions, but most of them are the kind of thing where if I run across them on TV, I will stop and watch them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even the ones I don't even like that much, I will usually stop and watch. But Any Given Sunday is probably near the top of that list of completely engrossing to me.
Yeah, I love that it's a football movie that's not a football movie. Right? On the one hand, it's a sports movie, and on the other hand, it's totally not a sports movie.
It's almost about the business.
Yeah. You can sit down as a football fan and love it, and I do enjoy my football.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, you can sit down as somebody who absolutely hates football and just get caught up in every character, and it's larger than life, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a full-on epic play on display, and it's just...
Yeah, and he overdoes it a little bit at times with the gladiatorial overtones and, you know, like Pacino's in an argument and Ben-Hur's playing in the background on TV and stuff. You know, it's like, really, Oliver, I think we get it. But it is a blast, and I think it gets to... it seems like it comes out of Stone's experience of football. Like, he loves it. You could tell he loves to watch football. He follows it. He's also really deeply cynical about it as a business and how it chews up these guys and how the actual sport itself is spoiled a little bit by the business aspect of it. And he doesn't try to resolve that. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like simultaneously there's this great love of football and this kind of skepticism about it. It's awesome.
It is.
It is. Like, it's easy to see, like, the way it could have gone, like you said, the sappy way and kind of, you know, resolved, and they get a good owner who's, you know, honest and everything, but that's not the nature of life, you know? This movie is bigger than that, I find.
Yeah, that's not gonna, you know, like... The idea that an NFL team is going to find a non-douchey owner at some point—not
a chance.
That would be Disney's version.
Yeah, exactly.
Any Given Sunday.
I guess I'll chime in next. I just didn't want to go first. Dan mentioned it, but I do definitely have to go with Platoon.
Yes.
For me, I mean, I saw Platoon, the first time I saw Platoon was in, I believe it was in 87, so I was pretty young, you know, I was 10 or 11 years old the first time I saw it. And thank you, you know, totally relaxed living environment and dad who just liked watching war movies with his son, you know. But, the first time I saw Platoon, I mean, when I was a kid, I enjoyed the action, you know, the war film aspect of it, being a child who grew up reading 80s G.I. Joe comics and watching Arnold Schwarzenegger movies, you know, it was more real, it was more gritty. But then as I got older, I started to kind of see a lot more of the genre, and I mean, movies like Go Tell the Spartans and a lot of the Vietnam stuff, a lot of the early Vietnam stuff that came before, stuff like Apocalypse Now, and I love Apocalypse Now, I mean, it's one of my favorite movies, but... Platoon really feels like a film that was made by someone who was there. You know, it really feels legitimate. Like, you get those sequences with, you know, the way the senior, like the officers or the career military guys are talking about all these young guys who were just brought over in the draft and stuff. You know, you feel that two-tiered system at work. You feel like the movie was written or filmed by someone who had to have experienced it. You know, it's very vivid in how it portrays the day-to-day experience of what went on there. And it's an eye-opener. It's a real, like, you know, especially for someone who wasn't alive when Vietnam was at its height, when Vietnam, you know, was all over the news and stuff like this. It was something I heard about after the fact. You know, every action movie made in the 80s had a Vietnam vet in it, you know. But Platoon really kind of, it was the first war movie that really did the war is hell message properly. It was the first one that you know, instead of being jingoistic or patriotic or being more about the psychology of war as a whole, I mean, you know, Apocalypse Now is not a war film. It's a psychological thriller. You know, it's a treatise on how war affects the psyche of man and such. You know, it's a different kind of movie than Platoon. Platoon really shows you that it wasn't pleasant. And before that, I mean, you had stuff like A Bridge Too Far, and you had, you know, all these World War II flicks where even when they did try to get realistic, there was a cause. There was that fighting for a common goal. And even when it was portrayed in a negative light, even when it was, you know, trying to show how war ground soldiers down and such, it was still had that kind of air of righteousness about it. There was nothing righteous about Platoon. You know, Platoon was just gritty, ugly war filmmaking. It might as well have been, you know, a correspondence film unedited. It was Vietnam uncensored is what I like to call it. You know, it was the gritty, ugly truth of what went on. The soldiers didn't know why they were there. They didn't have a cause. They didn't have any reason to be there other than the government told them they had to be. And they weren't told anything. You know, they were treated like mushrooms. Feed them shit and keep them in the dark. And from one day to the next, you know, all they could do was just live. They just had to be who they were. And, like, those personas really, like, I think a lot of it was with Stone. I think his memory of it, I think it was the guys with the strong personas that really got through unscathed. You know, it was the guys who could really differentiate from the pack and excel, but not in a, you know, career soldier kind of way, but more in a strength of character kind of way. And I think that's what he really did exceptionally well with that movie, was he gathered a collection of characters that were more than just war film cliches, you know, other than, what was his name, the first guy to die. Like, the guy comes in the same time as Charlie and, you know, this is my girl back home, I'm going to marry her, my Lucy Jean, you know. He's the quintessential war movie cliche, yes, but everything else in there, like Francisco Quinn and all of these other guys, you know, well, of course, Behringer and Defoe, who just knock it out of the park in this movie. You know, like, so many strong personalities in here. John C. McGilney's character. But they all had something that didn't feel, you know, that it was created by someone to kind of capture the attention of the audience. It wasn't something that was premeditated or calculated in a screenplay fashion. It was based on, you know, real ideas and real people that were encountered. It felt legitimate. It felt genuine. And, I mean, even now, I still say there's no other war film out there like it.
Although, I mean, I really love Platoon, and my only point of contention is some of the fighting between Defoe's character and Behringer does feel screenwritten to me. You know, the whole good and evil and, like, you know.
I don't think it's really good and evil so much as it's too, you know, diverting opinions on why they're over there. It's too different. You know, I think Behringer is the, this is the job we're given, the job we got to do. And Defoe's character is the more, you know, this is wrong, man. But Defoe's character is the moral grandstander, whereas Behringer's is to just get the job done, you know?
But then she, like, the thing that really kind of, you know, irritated me the last time I saw it was Sheen's final monologue, where he's like, oh, all this time, it was the war in my soul. And I'm like, oh, God.
To me, those two characters, the two sergeants are, they do kind of reveal structure. In terms of the screenplay, I would agree with Gabe on that. And for me, I've always liked Apocalypse Now better.
Oh, I do too. Overall. No doubt. Yeah.
But those two characters, they kind of move into almost like the plantation scene, in Apocalypse Now Redux, where it's like too explicit.
Mm-hmm.
It's making a point, too much through character. And, but man, I think you're dead on, Steve, that despite those screenwriterly things, that movie rides, like, I think the screenplay overall is okay. It's not great. It's really good. There's a lot of it that's really good. And the dialogue's great. It has its weaknesses, but the texture that Stone is able to give to that film, I mean, it really rides on that texture. Like, you just feel like, yeah, this is made by somebody who's there, who can get the soldiers right, who can kind of get the visual stuff right, and just has a feel for it. And that's what for me, it hasn't quite aged as well as I would have liked it to, but it's still Man, it's a good movie.
Yeah.
Overall. And that texture of war is just amazing what it pulls off.
I was just picking at nits. I mean, my dad rented it on Blu-ray, and I was like, okay, I'm just going to, like, watch 2 minutes to see how it looks.
No,
and
you're not.
I have to watch the whole thing.
Yeah, no, you're not. You don't watch 2 minutes of an Oliver Stone movie.
No, and it, because I saw it in the theater, and at the time that it came out, the kind of buzz and vibe about it was identical in a lot of ways to the buzz around the opening 15 minutes of Saving Private Ryan. Like, there was just a sense and a word on the street, like, this is so authentic that you will be uncomfortable watching this movie. Except it was about the whole movie and not the opening reel.
Yeah.
And that's pretty accurate. You know, when you watch it, it is uncomfortable at times. Or a lot throughout, you know, because you really do feel like it's a mess and this is what it was really like.
And
this is how much of a drag it was.
So much of it is pinned on those performances too. And I mean, I know it's awesome to, you know, super trendy right now and hipster to bash on Charlie Sheen and stuff. But man, he did a fantastic job in that movie, considering it was what, his second like big release, mm-hmm. You know, it was like his second film. And I mean, to pin that performance on him, that took a lot of guts on Stone's part, but Sheen really nailed it. You know, Sheen really, he delivered.
Yeah, it's like an under-the-radar kind of performance.
To go from the Wraith to Platoon?
Yeah, exactly.
That's a pretty big step in talent right there.
Yeah.
But, you know, Defoe and Berenger are like the attention magnets.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, their performances are so big, but they only work because of Sheen's performance.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's really hard to miss that. That his is very grounded, and it looks easy what he's doing, but it's not easy.
And then you got guys like Francisco Quinn, who was like, I watch him in it, and I'm like, man, how come I haven't seen him in anything else? Wasn't it his name?
And McGinley's hilarious. I remember in college, we watched that, and that scene where he does not want to go out.
I got a bad feeling about this one, Bob.
You just laugh hysterically every time it came up.
I just found out Francisco Quinn died in 2011.
Really?
Yeah.
That makes me sad.
And sorry for bringing it down like that, but can I also say just how awesome it was to see Keith David get a little more meat in a movie?
Yeah.
Yes.
King was awesome.
Just, it was a great collection of characters, and like everybody really like, I think a lot of it was that the characters were so like Stone did such a fine job of realizing. I'm not sure most of it was. I think Berenger and Defoe, like Elias and Burns, were drawn on his own thoughts. I think they were like an amalgam of people he knew or served under, but I think those were more like it was his own mental opposition to the war. It was his own two kind of. His diverted perspectives, and everybody else, I think, was at least partially or three quarters, you know, mostly based on people that he actually knew, and they really felt that way. Yeah,
like and one thing to remember about that chemistry that they got going is that they did like actual boot camp and stuff together before the filming started.
Yeah, I think that was Dale Dye's first boot camp, actually.
Yeah.
I love
it's a serious business. If you do boot camp with Dale Dye, you're a hard ass officially.
I love James Woods was offered a role in Platoon and turned it down because he couldn't face going into another jungle with Oliver Stone.
Seems reasonable.
Yeah. By all accounts, he's nothing if not demanding.
I'm just glad, you know, there was no, like, PTSD flashbacks or anything during filming.
Oh, by his account, he spent most of Vietnam stoned anyway, apparently, so it wouldn't really matter.
Okay, so he was Elias.
I think he was probably Charlie, actually.
Yeah, for
no,
sure.
No, he was definitely Francis. You ain't getting another click.
He was probably all of them at some point.
This is true.
He wrote the screenplay, so there's a little bit of him in everything.
One other scene, I got to mention one other scene, and it's just a simple scene. It's after Charlie Sheen has basically been initiated into the, you know, the pothead circle. And you see him, like, it's the aftermath of, you know, taking a brainer through the barrel of a gun and such. And he's more smug and he's more kind of in place. And it's the first time up to that point in the movie where you see him fit in with a group of people. I just think he plays that scene amazingly well. It's like he's finally picked out his stomping grounds, you know? But I just, there's something about that scene I love.
And something else that, like, I got on, I don't know, second or third viewing is the first scene when you see him coming out of the helicopter in Vietnam. At the same time, you're seeing, like, those, like, bodies being shipped out.
Yeah, yeah.
That just straight away, that puts you in that mind place where nothing is safe.
Who's next?
Guess I'm up. Okay, well, I really, really wanted to pick Platoon. Platoon is my favorite Stone movie, but it's not my pick for good tonight. And I got to go with 1986's Salvador.
Yes.
Nice pick.
Holy shit.
Was that your first time seeing it, John?
Yes, it was.
Oh, what an eye-opener that must have been.
Oh. And I'm a James Woods fan. I am. I like James Woods. This is probably my favorite James Woods performance. It's yes. Also possibly my favorite Jim Belushi performance, narrowly edging out Thief and K-9. Although, wait, I forgot about Taking Care of Business. I found Salvador to be both discomforting and enthralling. Like, there is some horrible, horrible stuff going on in this movie, but it's a train wreck. I cannot look away from it. You know, right from the strobe flicker during the opening, I'm buckled in. And it's interesting seeing this after having seen Platoon, you know, 15, 20 times in my life. I can see, you can see Stone is crafting the framework in which he's going to be building movies upon. It's all there visible, and I've heard Salvador described as an uneven film, and I can't entirely disagree. However, like, I'm a real sucker for stories of redemption, especially when I love flawed protagonists, and they don't get much more flawed than Rick Boyle was in this movie. And Woods is just what a fascinating primal performance. I love, like, all the little odd ticks and the weird line timing and everything to keep you guessing. And it's just watching this complete down and out slime bag dealing with a growing conscience as he's caught in just a swelling tide of violence. It was a great, great movie.
I found the biggest thing with me, what always kind of sticks with me with Salvador, is it always felt so much bigger than it actually was. You know, the movie always felt so much larger in scale than it actually was. Like, wasn't it, like, dirt cheap? Wasn't it, like, $5 million or something like that? It does not feel like a $5 million movie, you know?
Man, okay. The scene in the dumping ground. That is just... That looks like a $10 million shot, right?
Yeah.
Just fantastic, fantastic movie.
Really, really
good. Yeah, it's.
I don't want to spoil it for anyone because all these years.
I mean, the thing I always think about is I went to Platoon with my dad, and I remember before we went, he was like, "All right, we're gonna go see this movie, and buckle up because it's about Vietnam, and it's directed by the dude who did Salvador, and we'd seen Salvador like on VHS, I think." And so just based on Salvador, we knew we were getting into something heavy with Platoon, you know?
Yeah.
Cause I mean, Salvador is serious business, but really powerful. And you're right that it's been a while since I've seen it, but it is kind of low budget, run and gun, but man, the feeling of it is just epic. I mean, huge epic. And I thought, you know, there was sort of these kind of movies at that time all over the place, like The Killing Fields and stuff like that. And I don't remember what year Killing Fields came out, but, you know, different episode, subject matter, but similar kind of vibe, similar emotional vibe and stuff.
Very bleak.
And I remember thinking that, yeah, bleak. I remember thinking Salvador just blew The Killing Fields out of the water.
Yeah.
When I saw it, just, and Woods is, A, the man is insane. but, you know, I think you're right that that movie uses his talents like none other, really, that I can think of in his career. I mean,
well, it was,
I don't think
he
won an Oscar for that, but he should, or did he?
No, he didn't for Salvador. I think he was nominated, though.
But he, it was before he got the whole tough guy psycho shtick.
Right.
Right, and he's kind of, you got raw James Woods.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's just,
and that's raw.
Yeah, not a pleasant performance.
No. Because if in your personal life you're too crazy for Sean Young,
yeah,
you're crazy. You are batshit crazy, if that's the case.
Can I just say as well, I can remember now seeing this on the video store shelf at Alan's Video when I saw the poster for it. That's a great poster.
Mm-hmm.
The really crappy screen capture.
Yeah.
Of James Woods at the camera. And I think it actually kind of looks like a magazine cover.
Yeah. I think that's the intent, because there's a photography that's very important in the script.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was somebody else in this movie I was really impressed with, too. I think it was John Savage played the other photojournalist.
Was it John
Savage? And,
yes, it was, yes. Yeah.
Played mm-hmm. Cassidy.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was another great performance. And I'm not going to lie, I nearly jumped off the couch and cheered when I saw the girl from Predator.
El Pidia Carrillo.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I mean, right away, also, that kind of peg stone for this is being topical. I mean, Salvador was a big topic in the 80s, and he was right.
It was, what, a 12-year civil war?
Yeah. And he catches lightning in a bottle, and once again, showing stuff realistically and in all the grimy business, you know, going under the surface and showing the truth of how ugly this can get.
Yeah, I don't think Oliver Stone was a very happy person in the 80s.
I don't think – I still don't think he's a very happy person.
I don't think so.
I don't think Oliver Stone liked his father very much.
I don't think he likes
What's great about his 80s work is it's not reductive. You know, he doesn't try to simplify the politics of it.
No.
He's more like a photojournalist, actually.
He wants it to be messy and really unresolvable in a lot of ways. He wants Vietnam to feel like that. He wants the Civil War in El Salvador to feel like that, to feel like it's such a big mess that there's not really a political solution to it. It's just
links to JFK, of course.
Yeah, it's like he is tackling it like a photojournalist. You know, he just wants to present what he perceives as the truth rather than, you know, and now whether he's dead on or not is, you know, always up for debate. But I don't think he wants to color it in any way, shape or form. I think he actually really wants to just kind of present what he feels is truth.
Mm-hmm.
Uncompromising, horrible, burning that light kind of truth.
Yeah.
At least in the 80s.
Yes. Yeah.
When there were mountains of cocaine.
Yes.
He mentioned he wrote Scarface, right?
Yeah, he wrote Scarface. And
so, like the Tony Montana at the desk with the growing, like you can witness his degeneration by the size of the pile of coke in front of him.
That was all based on Oliver Stone's actual occurrences in the 70s, right?
Yeah, according to the Wikipedia page, he kicked his habit while writing Scarface.
Brian De Palma witnessed him and then just visualized that scene in his head.
Yes. Yeah. It's just Scarface is just a narrative visualization of what was going on inside Oliver Stone's head as he was writing it.
Everybody's out to get me.
The world is yours.
I just won a goddamn Oscar for Midnight Express.
The world is yours, but you can't have mutant pigs in your Conan movie.
Apparently he melted that Oscar and used the money to buy a giant mound of cocaine.
I was hoping you were going to say
perhaps a machine gun.
He smelted it into an opium pipe.
All right. For my good, I'm not going to go for my favorite Oliver Stone movie because I'm pretty sure it will pop up back later in the ugly section.
I have no doubt.
But I will go with what I personally consider is a strongest movie, and that is Born on the 4th of July. For me, it feels as his most complete view of what the Vietnam War was, because, I mean, he made three movies about Vietnam, and Platoon is about the grunts. Heaven and Earth is more about, like, what the aftermath of the war, what did it both to Vietnam and both to the people who came home and tried to lead a normal life. And Born on the 4th of July shows us both the war and how it can change somebody who loves his country very much into a defender of the freedom of speech, which is essential to the country, but also a defender of said war. And how somebody can lose that idealism. And I mean, this feels, again, I mean, all of Stone's movies are personal, but this to me feels like really close to home for him. And I mean, if anybody has any doubts about Tom Cruise being an actor, watch Born on the 4th of July.
Oh, hell yes.
So he goes through so many shades of different of the character's progression from young idealism to the soldier to the getting back on his feet again and trying to live, and then to the guy who goes out on the streets and does the speeches. I mean, he's got an amazing arc to go through, and he plays all of those notes perfectly. And the movie is engrossing from start to finish. It's beautiful to look at. I mean, I think Robert Richardson, is it Robert? Yeah, anyways, he really surpassed himself in this movie. I mean, I think there's shades of red, white, and blue in almost every frame.
I think it's, it's one of those movies. Again, It treads on some of the same ground as Platoon in terms of the war is hell kind of situation. And I think, too, it's kind of a – if Platoon is what was experienced by Stone in Vietnam, if Platoon were his experiences, I could very easily see Born on the 4th of July being, his own mental anguish, his own – like why he became the way he did, why he was such an outspoken critic and that sort of thing. Born on the 4th of July is definitely the logical aftermath of Platoon,
And it was weird for me because, of course, I was pretty young when this came out. So I saw it after seeing Forrest Gump and I was like, man, this is Luton and Dan. But if he was taking seriously,
That's so funny because I was just thinking as you were talking that Born on the 4th of July is a kind of I don't want to say companion because it's almost like the dark, older, more serious, more reputable brother of Forrest Gump. I mean, Forrest Gump is sort of silly and stupid. I'm not a fan of the movie, frankly, but they cover similar ground, and Born on the 4th of July covers it so much better. And so much more honestly than Gump does. And, it's just weird that they are similar in some weird way. But, it's been a while since I've seen it, but man, it's a good ride, a tough ride, but a good one.
It's a bleak movie.
Definitely. And I mean, all that, those readaptation scenes, I mean, they hit you hard.
They do, yeah.
In the hospital, and that hospital is so grody and unsanitary, too.
The one thing that turns me from Born on the 4th of July, and this is a shallow criticism, but a criticism nonetheless, is the music. I'm not a big fan of the score. I find it kind of, it robs the film of a little bit of its power sometimes, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's always a place where Oliver Stone will put too much on his movie, you know?
Subtlety is not one of his strong suits, you know? Is not in his vocabulary. But
funny, you could say the same thing about John Williams.
I was about to say, was it John Williams who did it?
It was John Williams.
Oh, okay, right. Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
And that's not a knock on John Williams.
No, it's just, you know, I don't know. It was just, I do remember some of the scenes in it now, and, like, I'm thinking back to it. It's been a few years since I've seen it last. And, like, I am, you know, it's more the music and those certain, like, those scenes that feel really melodramatic because of the underscoring, you know?
And to another thing I appreciated was, like, having Willem Dafoe back, and he's kind of playing Elias, if he had survived.
Yeah.
Funny, his name is Charlie, too.
Maybe it's metaphor. Maybe after Vietnam.
It's one of those Oliver Stone conspiracies.
Yeah, Charlie became Elias.
Maybe Stone saw in the future and saw what would happen to Charlie Sheen.
Yeah.
I just enjoy watching a movie that's almost 2.5 hours long, and most of that running time, Tom Cruise looks like a young David Crosby.
And that's another thing about the length. I mean, that it's 2.5 hours long, but it feels pretty quick. I noticed that about Nixon. I mean, that movie's 3 hours and 30 minutes long, but you don't really feel it because Stone grabs you by the balls.
I find that something that Stone does pretty well, actually, is pacing.
All right, let's move on to our bads. Once again, a bad is not a movie that is necessarily bad, but a movie that is this close to being a good but has too many flaws, or a movie that we love despite its flaws. So let's go with you, Mr. Mancini, once again.
All right, my bad falls into the latter category. I think it is a bad movie. It's not even really close to being a good movie, but it's another one where if I stumble upon it, I will watch the whole thing. I will thoroughly enjoy it. Some of that will be laughing at it instead of with it. But it's The Doors, which is the thing that is hilarious. Well, there are numerous things that are hilarious about The Doors to me. One of them being it's one of the only movies or the only movie that I can think of that makes an auto accident with Native Americans hilarious somehow. But it, you know, Oliver Stone is every single movie he's trying to convince us of whatever it is that he's trying to convince us of. And the beauty of it, whether you agree or not, is he believes what he is saying.
Exactly.
100%.
Yeah.
He is committed to it, except in The Doors. The Doors is a movie where I feel like he believed this crap when he was like 18, and then he's making this movie as a middle-aged man, and he doesn't really believe it anymore. He doesn't really believe that there's anything romantic about a fat, alcoholic 27-year-old dying. A premature death anymore, but he did when he was a kid, and he's trying to desperately to pull it off. He's trying desperately to still think of The Doors the way he did, you know, when he was about to go to Vietnam probably. And, it's just hilariously bad. It follows the format of every bad rock biopic, except with some extra weirdness. It is beautifully shot. Val Kilmer. He's pretty awesome.
Kilmer is awesome in this movie.
Yes. There's a couple times where Kilmer comes through.
Yeah.
And you know, oh, you know, there's some acting going on right there. But for the most part, I mean, his singing is great. He looks like Morrison. But it's got all the problems of, you know, too much story, even though it's a long movie, in too short a time. And so everything's compressed and you can never figure out how long it's been between scenes and, you know, all that kind of nonsense that is always true of all the bad rock biopics, and Elvis movies and stuff like that. But, man, I love sitting down and watching it if it happens to come on, because it's, I know that I will laugh. I know I'll have a good time. And, you know, I like the Doors music, so well, I'll enjoy that too.
I think you really got something by saying that he was kind of disenchanted with this ideology, because he really goes out of his way to picture Morrison as a thoroughly despicable human being, you know?
And I think, you know, like we said about Salvador and Platoon, I mean, you know, this I think this was the truth as Oliver Stone saw it, you know, and there's a certain amount of hero worship there. Like Dan said, you know, like when he was young, he probably thought Jim Morrison was the coolest guy alive. And I guess the closest comparison I could give for our generation would be, I know, grown Kurt Cobain. You know, yeah. when I was in high school, I thought Kurt Cobain was, you know, the poster boy for 90s angst.
Cat's ass.
Well, no, not so much. I was more Eddie Vedder than Kurt Cobain. But, you know, either way, these guys were poster boys for, you know, my generation. These were Generation X angsty, you know, just, they were different characters. And then, I mean, now I look back on Kurt Cobain, I was like, he was just a troubled idiot who, you know, wrote crappy song lyrics and didn't know how to play guitar. But I think there's a lot of that going on with Stone. I think, you know, the Doors feels like a Doors fan or someone who was a Doors fan in their childhood who's now moved into, like, their classic rock phase. Writing a movie about a band. It'd be like if I turned around tomorrow and wrote a biography on Metallica. You know, it's like, sure, I still like them. Sure, I still listen to them every now and again, but I don't exactly follow the news and find out what's happening in the land of Metallica these days.
You know that Lars Ulrich is an asshole.
But it strikes me like exactly Dan hit the nail on the head. Really, it feels like a movie that, you know, yeah, at one point or another in his life, this definitely meant something to him, and he's trying to get that across. That, like, you know, the Doors used to be really, really cool once, but then it turned out that Jim Morrison was just a fat idiot.
Right. Right.
Well, no, he wasn't always a fat idiot, though. He was just an idiot.
Right. Once he was just an idiot.
Yeah, the fatness was like his penance for his crimes.
Yeah. There we go.
And it's so great that it hits all those right beats of, like, oh, look, it's Ed Sullivan.
Yeah.
It's a guy in, like, prosthetic makeup. And then, oh, look, it's Andy Warhol. And it's, you know, I don't even remember.
It's like Michael Mann's
I think it's Crispin Glover.
Yes, you're right. It's Crispin Glover in a bad wig.
You know. Oh, look, now Jim Morrison is addicted to drugs.
Oh, look.
Oh, they're throwing plates, he and his girlfriend. Yeah.
Oh, look, there's a witch in his apartment.
Every time one of you jumps in with another "and then" or "oh, look," I just keep hearing the opening of Peace Frog whenever you start to describe it.
Oh, I love that
look,
song.
They're throwing plates.
Oh, how I love that song.
That's a fantastic song.
Well, that's the positive thing that the Doors movie did, is reintroduce that band to a younger generation, because, I mean, they were everywhere, you know?
It did. I think it definitely kind of relaunched the band a little bit. I mean, not that they ever really disappeared. I mean, they were always kind of AM gold, you know? But I think, if anything, it brought them back into the FM generation a little. But it was timed well, too. You know, it came around right at the beginning of that kind of classic rock revival. You had bands like AC/DC and Black Sabbath getting popular again, you know? So it came along at the right time, I think.
Yeah, what year was that?
It was 91, I think.
91.
Yeah.
So just at the beginning of grunge, too. And you have to wonder, like, how calculated, because there is a timing thing to Stone's movies.
Oh, yeah.
They are timing. I mean, they are very timely. And how much was he conscious of the fact that, you know, he couldn't have really been, because they had to start production in 90 or earlier. But, I mean, it did kind of coincide with the rise of Cobain. And, you know, he's painting this picture of, here was the Kurt Cobain of the 1960s.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, you know. And so, you know, the movie was popular, at least. I was in college, so it was popular among college kids.
I was
it definitely in- made a connection to us between the music that we were listening to and finally being freed of hair metal.
You shut your mouth.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, okay, The Doors was 91. In 1990, Rat had a major hit with Nobody Rides for Free. Right. So in one short year, we jumped from Point Break to The Doors.
Yeah.
I've never actually seen this movie.
I own it.
I'm very interested. How is Colin McLaughlin as Manzarek?
He's good. I mean, like,
he's good.
He's far from.
Because I love Manzarek, right?
Yeah, it really is. You know, it shouldn't be called The Doors. It should be called like Jim Morrison or something, because it is more about him.
Yeah.
Than the band, you know.
Yeah,
Manzarek
is sort of a square in it, pretty much.
Yeah.
So like Colin McLaughlin.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty much perfect casting.
Oh, wait, Michael Wincott's in this movie.
Michael Wincott.
That just makes me want to talk about talk radio.
We haven't had a Michael Wincott sighting in a while.
So what's your bet, Steve?
My bet for Mr. Oliver Stone. I'm going to go with a movie that I love very, very deeply, actually. I absolutely adore the movie for the craftsmanship, for the acting, for how it's put together, but I don't think Stone ever really had an entirely clear blueprint in his head into how he wanted to assemble it, and that's Alexander.
You bastard.
I love Alexander. I think it's a fantastic movie. I think Colin Farrell is absolutely phenomenal in it, but I mean, I got a big man crush on Colin Farrell anyway. I'll admit that right up front. You know, I think the guy is fantastic. But I think it's a movie that, you know, hits all the right beats in terms of how you should do one of these historical epics. And I think, unfortunately for it, it kind of got lumped into the same category as Troy and Gladiator. And, you know, and it's not at all like any of those movies. You know, like, it doesn't really have the same feel as, definitely not as Troy. I mean, Troy in its theatrical cut form was ridiculous. The director's cut was pretty good, but that's for another time. But Alexander, I think, you know, so many people got caught up in the whole same-sex escapades that, like, they lost sight of the movie itself. And, I mean, Colin Farrell at the time was on a bit of a Hollywood, you know, fallout because of his, you know, his extracurricular activities. Hollywood never likes to see their golden boys out drinking and cavorting and cheating on their girlfriends and whatnot. So, you know, he was kind of
being 23-year-old Irishman.
Yeah, exactly. You know, just generally being what we Canadians call Friday nighters. So, you know, it was a situation, I think, where, you know, Farrell's star was starting to fall, and then all of this, you know, conservative, he was portrayed as homosexual and yada, yada, yada. It's like, you know, this, and Stone said it himself, you know, Stone said it, I believe it was just before the movie came out. Like, what effing difference does it make? It makes no difference whatsoever. You know, but the movie was so harshly criticized for having Alexander have a boyfriend on screen. You know, and I mean, this guy was, it was
Greek.
Number one, he was Greek. It was a different time. This is how they roll. And, you know, it's just the fact
that, and also his boyfriend was Jared Leto.
Oh, I mean,
who, let's face facts, is fabulous.
Mm-hmm. And almost a girlfriend. So come on.
And I can't remember, Alexander, I don't know if it's in the final cut, but doesn't this open with a scene of Christopher Plummer talking about how noble it is?
One of the three cuts does. There's three different cuts of the film. There's your theatrical cut, which was the...
Because I thought the final cut actually opened with an Anthony Hopkins scene.
I believe, yes, it does. I think it does. And the director's cut, I think, was similar. My favorite of the three is the revisited cut, which is like kind of his definitive final version, which is the longest of the three by a good stretch. It does have all the director's cut material, so it's arranged more like the director's cut. And like, it does have a lot of stuff that was cut from the original theatrical cut, which he had cut because it was criticized. And I think it works really, really well with the director's cut structure. Like, it rearranges the first battle sequence. It's not told in a linear fashion like it was in the theatrical cut. But it's just, it's something, you know, like, I think the movie is really a damn fine epic piece of filmmaking. You know, it really does a fantastic job of showing who this figure might have been. And
I have a question, Steve. Do you think the alternate cuts are as much a revelation as, like, Kingdom of Heaven was? Or
yes and no.
Yeah.
In some respects, yes, because they're just so different than the theatrical cut. Like, because, I mean, he doesn't just, you know, add in scenes. He rearranges the entire movie. You know, he moves stuff around. He shifts entire sequences. And that does make it feel different, like it messes with pacing and stuff like that, but the theatrical cut felt so laborious, and that's something I'm not used to from Stone, whereas the director's cut and the revisited cut both move like stink. And you don't get the same, like Kingdom of Heaven was a competent film when it was released, it just felt empty, but then you see the director's cut and it's like, oh my god. And I mean, Alexander never feels empty. It never feels phoned in any version. There's always, you know, Stone's entire heart and soul was in this movie. He was very devoted to this film. And you can tell it's something that, like, there was no studio interference. There was no, you know, trimming made for mainstream audiences because they didn't want a movie running over 2.5 hours like you got with Kingdom of Heaven, you know. It was always Stone's project, and it was always a pet project. But it just, you know, it's different takes on the same material. And they do feel different. I mean, you know, they are different films. They are very different films. And I do think that the director's cut and the revisited cut work better, but they're not like the revelation that Kingdom of Heaven was.
Okay.
Yeah, I always felt like Alexander fell prey to Stone's reputation for taking on contemporary stories.
Yeah.
And controversy. So it was almost like the same-sex stuff, even though there was all this controversy around it, it was almost like when people saw it, there was a disappointment that it wasn't that big a deal.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, it's an Oliver Stone movie. It should all be about dudes banging dudes. Well, Alex, you know.
They wanted the entire three-hour runtime to be...
So it was almost like, perversely, people complained about it, and then they were disappointed that...
It wasn't that shocking.
A big part of the...
Well, they wanted the entire movie to be Philip's wedding scene.
Yeah.
Right.
They wanted, you know, they were thinking the conspiracy nut of JFK crossed with the out-and-out ridiculousness of Natural Born Killers. And they didn't get that. They got Stone's typical, you know, what he perceived as truth. You know?
Alexander was also my choice for bad. Because it is a movie I enjoy despite its flaws, and they are many. You know, I'm just gonna go out and say it. I fucking hate Vangelis. I think he's the cheesiest of cheese. And like the opening credits of the movie where you've got the you know, the sudden like the bust of Alexander turns to face the camera, and you get the big burst of heroic music, and that is just it's terrible.
It is, yeah, you're right.
It's really that's horrible.
Thanks for reminding me, John.
It's at these moments, Alexander, it's a train wreck of Imperian proportions. But for every one of those moments, there's a wild and woolly Val Kilmer.
And it's just conniving and evil Angelina Jolie.
Yeah, I was, well, yes. For every measure of venom, I can spit at Angelina Jolie for choosing to play Alexander's mother as Evil Lynn from He-Man.
Yes.
There's the immensely enjoyable... Now, is it called the final cut or the revisited cut? The one I remember, it was a blue cover with Alexander and there's like a red hawk over his eyes.
That's the revisited cut.
That's the revisited cut? Okay, that's the one I have. And I should have just gone taken off the shelf and looked at it. You know, and I'm a sucker for these big, boisterous historical epics. Even ones like Alexander, which are obviously drunk.
Yeah. Like, yes.
This movie is the Brian Blessed of historical epics. And hey, Brian Blessed is in it. I mean, it's loud. But it's beautiful. The movie's beautifully shot. You know, people complained about the fact that everyone spoke with an Irish accent to cover up the fact that Colin Farrell can't speak without having an Irish accent.
Well, it is one way to do it.
No, but I think it really worked. Like, I still love when when he's giving chase to Darius, I believe the king of Persia. And that hilarious, you can run to the ends of the earth, coward, but you'll never be able to run from me.
Now that you've said it, I just wish that Brian Blessed as Hawkman was in the movie.
Flash Gordon!
God and King Richard!
You!
Now, what was his the line I keep bringing up from obviously I've had too much wine, I can't remember it, from High Road to China? Bring it up whenever Beth says anything.
Oh, I loved him in High Road to China, too.
Yeah, Brian,
oh, man. He's just beard and teeth.
Greatest casting ever.
I love High Road to China.
You want to, like, we're joking around about Kurt Russell's beard? No, you want to see a textured beard?
I'd forgotten he was in Alexander. Was he in Alexander?
Yes, he was the wrestling trainer.
Oh!
Oh, yeah.
The very naked wrestling trainer. Yeah.
I love Alexander.
All right.
Rosario Dawson's in it.
Oh, yeah. And she's fabulous.
Is she ever in it? For my bad, I chose a qualified bad, and that is the third part of Stone's films about Vietnam, Heaven and Earth. For a good part of the movie, he focuses on this young Vietnamese girl and her life in Vietnam, and that is very interesting and engrossing, but the movie is too melodramatic for its own good. Again, the length feels ungainly, and once they go back to America, it kind of totally loses its footing and drowns. But it's like he's trying to make this big, sweeping love epic, and like, since he's Oliver Stone, he has to lay whatever he's doing extra, and he puts extra schmaltz on it, on this movie, with sweeping chords and tearful scenes and slow-mo, and you're like, oh, please. But, you know, there are some very interesting parts. It shows a side of the Vietnam War that we've rarely ever seen, the aftermath of the Americans leaving.
Yeah,
and it does look beautiful.
I'm kind of a fan of Heaven and Earth, actually. I do kind of like it. I gotta say, it's, you know, I like Tommy Lee Jones in it, which is rare because I normally hate Tommy Lee Jones, but I do really enjoy his performance in it. And like you said, it does show a side that you don't see very often outside of, like, you know, the CNN clips of, like, you know, the helicopter, the last helicopter leaving Saigon, you know, stuff like this. And I don't know, I found it was like a lot like Born on the 4th of July. I think it felt like, you know, someone's, you know, recollections of the aftermath, you know?
But at the same time, I mean, it's definitely not top tier. It's kind of a mediocre film, you know? To me, anyways. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't quite work, you know? It could be better.
I enjoy it. I do consider it. I guess I could call it a bad, because I do find it's one of the few Stone movies where the pacing is a little screwy. But I think I have a greater appreciation for it than most people I talk to. And I understand why it wasn't held to the same high standards as Born on the 4th of July or Platoon. But, you know, I think as, like, kind of the closing chapter of a trilogy, you know, I think it works pretty well. I think it actually mm-hmm. does. I think it's necessary to have it with the other two, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's pretty much
sort of more abstracted, you know? Like, yeah. I feel like Born on the 4th of July is so much more immediate because it is Stone's experience, and Heaven and Earth is, it's not that. I mean, it's truth still, but it's not emerging from his
his own experience.
His right. Yeah.
Well,
there's a distance to it.
I think his wife is Vietnamese, isn't she?
She is. Yeah.
I was like, maybe that's the way he was seeing this movie. It was through his like his wife's eyes. He's really you feel like kind of he's really trying to look through someone else's eyes at this topic instead of using his own. You know, which is commendable, of course. But, you know, Stone doing a movie where the main character is a woman, it can't really work, I think.
Yeah, it'd be like Samuel Fuller doing that, you know, like, all right, this is weird.
I just had a horrible thought. Well, I mean, you know, I might as well say it. If Sam Fuller made a film where a woman was the main character, she would stay in the kitchen the entire time making sandwiches and get raped repeatedly.
That's horrific and 100% accurate.
I don't think I like the big red one anymore.
What the heck? My cat just tipped something over.
My wife's going to beat me when she gets home just for being party to this. Why didn't you stop him, John? Why didn't you stop him?
Well, Mitch says that, you know, every episode he listens to, he thinks someone is going to hear this and it's going to start a war. So we got to get at least one controversial comment in there.
Now, with that said, let's go on to our ugly, and that is, from our point of view, the worst movie Oliver Stone has made, or just the one that we hate the most.
Torrent 3. Oh, no, wait, he only acted in that.
Seizure. No, I've not seen it. So, Dan, what's your choice for ugly?
I'm pulling out all the stops here, so I'm going as controversial as I can possibly go.
Ooh.
My ugly for Stone is Wall Street. To paraphrase Roger Ebert, I hate this movie. It is all of Oliver Stone's worst tendencies brought to life in one movie. And it is the one movie of his. Well, there's a couple, but it's the one main movie, one most popular movie of his that is one where I cannot watch it if it comes on. It is, to me, this is a movie where, well, his career is, he likes to think of himself as a sort of prophetic figure, you know, that he sees things as none of us can see them. And he is presenting us with truths that are outside of our ability to access them because we aren't as brilliant as he is. And very often those truths are blatantly obvious. They're nothing special. They're easily seen. And to me, Wall Street is that. Greed is bad. You know, the American dream at the root of it is greed. Those kind of observations, it's like, yeah, Oliver, we get it. You know, like we knew that before we walked into the film. You have not presented us with really any new information. This is not prophetic. You're patting yourself on the back.
This is not a morality tale. It's a fucking Berenstain Bears story.
Right. And cannot stand it. The only part of it I like is when Charlie Sheen starts crying when they arrest him at the end, which I do think is hilarious. But
you cold bastard.
And it's not as though, you know, I mean, I understand that some people will disagree with it on political terms or economic terms, or I have no problem with it at that level. It's just the ham-fistedness of it that irritates me more than any of his other movies for some reason. And yeah, I can't stand it, and it is definitely my ugly, even though I know that it's revered by many people.
I'm not a fan of it. Like, I think it stands out like a sore thumb in Stone's filmography. Like, I don't understand where it fits, you know? But I got to give it to Douglas and Sheen. I mean, I think both Sheens or whatever, you know, I think they act the shit out of it. I really do. I think, like, Douglas does a fantastic...
This is good.
Yeah, and...
But for goodness sakes, he's a capitalist scumbag.
Oh, yeah.
And Oliver names him Gecko. And it's like, all right, that's not obvious at all, Oliver. Thank you.
Yeah, and that's the thing with it. Like, I think the smug douchiness quotient is just off the scale. You know,
but I mean, the interesting to me, the where it kind of fits is that, well, as I said, his dad was a stockbroker.
Yeah.
And he also did some of that work. And the scenes in the office when they're cold calling and everything like that, that does feel, that's to me the gripping part of the movie. You know, those scenes do feel real. All the little things just in the office before he starts dealing with Gecko. And also the relationship between the father and the son, which is kind of like the actual interesting thing in this movie, you know?
Yeah, I could see
texture.
That.
What I can't get past is the steak tartare scene. You want to talk about a bag of doorknobs?
Again, subtlety is not one of his strong suits.
No, no,
get it?
Not.
Get it? He's a shark, so he's eating raw meat.
Oh my God, that's brilliant. I never realized that before now.
Woo!
I bet if he came up with that last minute on the set, you know,
yeah.
He's sending it an
no,
assistant
Michael, you're not
running around, get me steak tartare!
Right now!
Inspiration!
Even better, take the steak and rub it through your hair.
Just give me a big plate of chum.
Just shovel some of this chum. Yeah, it's a. I'm not. I, to a certain degree, can enjoy Wall Street, but it's a very clumsy,
yeah,
loud, braggadocious movie.
Yeah, that's a good word for it too.
And Daryl Anna could just be replaced by a plywood. And
that's true. In any of her.
You, at least, no, you're not going to badmouth Pris.
Well, yeah, that's true.
I'm hungry, Sebastian.
Yeah, she's straight up evil in that movie.
Is it me now? Yeah, it is me, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, do you want to let it out, Steve?
I'm going to hurt you, Gabe. I'm going to wound you deeply right now. I have to go with Natural Born Killers.
Yeah.
And John Claps.
Not just any claps. You totally know you're getting Citizen Kane.
I'm getting the Citizen Kane clap right now.
Well, I knew this would be coming anyway.
I'm sorry. I really am. But, you know, just the whole killers as celebrity media frenzy, heavy-handed metaphor is just so completely and utterly ridiculous. He could teach Tony Scott a thing or two about being ADD. You know, like it's, I think the entire movie is a mess. I think it's overplayed, overwrought. I think it cuts way too much, and then other times it doesn't cut enough. I think that Woody Harrelson absolutely sucks in it.
Oh,
man, I hate the movie. I can't watch it. And, you know, I understand it was experimentation on Stone's part. You know, I understand that he was doing something a little different, something outside the norm. And, I mean, the foundation was kind of laid a little bit with the psychedelia and the different film stocks and stuff, you know. But Natural Born Killers just takes it to such a degree that it becomes nonsensical. It's just, you know, for all of these directors who come out there, like, somewhat accomplished, like, fairly polished action directors who are all, you know, derided by critics as just being music video directors, no. You're wrong. Natural Born Killers is a music video. You know,
no,
like,
that's what it's meant to be.
But it's just, and again, we get into the same problem.
Yeah, but it's a shitty music video, Gabe. It's a Babylon AD music video.
No, it's a, you know, like Tina Turner or the Fugees or something. You know, it's just, oh, it, like, and I mean, it tries so earnestly to get its point across without, you know, writing it with Crayola crayon on neon-colored bristleboard and flashing it in your face, and yet it still feels like he wrote it on neon bristleboard with Crayola crayon and is flashing it in your face. Again, subtlety is not one of his, you know, fortes, and this is the most unsubtle and obnoxious movie he's done. And, I mean, you know, yes, okay, maybe that is the whole point, but, you know, the metaphor is just, to me, it's lost completely. It's like there's nothing clever about it. It's just the movie beating you over the head with its message, you know?
It's like Wall Street. It's
Yeah, exactly.
Stone. It's Stone in profit mode,
yeah,
making a point that we all already understand,
yeah,
that he thinks we don't, and we don't see. And the thing that always, you know, it's however long, I believe it's 4 days long.
Yeah, something like that.
Based on my last viewing. and the thing that always gets me about it is the Jane's Addiction song, Ted Just Admit It,
yeah,
makes the same point in 6 minutes.
Yeah.
And it does it more artfully. And it's actually fun and disturbing at the same time. It does everything that Natural Born Killers tries to do in under 10 minutes.
Well, I'm going to say that I knew this was coming and that I was going
to
be...
No, sir. We haven't even gotten to Robert Downey Jr. yet.
No.
Okay, I just got to say it. Robert Downey Jr. needed prison. Because he was a good actor when he got out.
Yes.
He is, and as much as I hate Woody Harrelson in this movie, and Grouch was in this, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He was there.
Yes, he was. But Robert Downey Jr. is just terrible. He's worse than Rodney Dangerfield. I just like that to sink in. Worse than Rodney Dangerfield. And I only saw Natural Born Killers a couple years ago. I managed to miss it all through the 90s when all of my my little idiot friends, because we were all 12-year-old morons back then. You know, we loved our Nirvana. But when everyone told me how amazing it was, how brilliant it was in that, I managed to avoid seeing it. And Elizabeth and I rented it one night right after the cool Warner Brothers book Blu-ray came out, and I sat down and watched it, and I was like, this is what all the acclaim was about? It's nothing.
And I will say, too, another thing that kind of bugs me about it, there are little bits and pieces of Quentin Tarantino all over this. And I mean, you know, I know that like it's not a Tarantino film in the strictest sense, and he's distanced himself from it. And he said, you know, Oliver Stone basically took his screenplay and cut it up and fed it through a meat grinder and whatever else. But there is little bits of you know, Tarantino all over it. His DNA is still in there, and it's the worst of Tarantino. You know, it's the very, very worst of his little foibles, his little idiosyncrasies, like the dialogue, that crappy hipster dialogue and names like, you know, what was it, Detective Scagnetti, you know, stuff like this.
It's, yeah, Warden McCluskey. It's the Tarantino that thinks he's intelligent.
Yeah.
As opposed to the Tarantino that puts an animated sequence in his movie.
I'm sorry, Gabe. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Hey,
Marshall Bell was in this.
Was he really?
And Grandel Bush.
And Russell Means playing. Yeah, Russell Means playing old Indian.
Was it the same old Indian?
Oh my God. Okay. Wait a second. Prison inmates, Dennis Leary and Bret Hitman Hart.
Yeah.
I'm buying this tomorrow.
The important thing, though, John, any Kim Coates, any Brian Blessed, or any Michael Wincott? No.
There's the Barbarian Brothers in a cut scene. Come on.
Our cab's broken, so we're taking it back to the shop, okay? Take it easy.
I'll keep it short and sweet, and basically I love this movie for every reason that most people will hate it.
Those reasons are Gabe is French.
Because it is overblown, because it's so crazy and all over the place, and it hits you on the head with a hammer. I love those Lovers on the Run movies. This is like, I'm like, I don't want to get too far into this, but like, this is like, if Nietzsche had made a movie, it would be Natural Born Killers, you know?
And everything about that sentence is exactly why I hate it.
All right. I don't have any strength to defend it, because I know I'm not going to win.
No, I. You know what? I understand why you like it, Gabe. You're French.
I just made that joke, Steve. Jesus.
But to me, that, you know, the fact that it is so blatant and it's so overblown and so cut and so all over the place does work in what the movie is trying to do. And to me, the movie attains, you know, its goals. And I'll leave it at that.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Okay. Doesn't Robert Downey Jr. throw his arms out in the Jesus Christ pose before he gets shot?
Yes.
Yes, he does. Yes.
That's everything you need to know about this
movie.
Yes,
we'll never forget about that.
I'm going to move on to My Ugly now.
Okay.
Okay. And I'm going to choose My Ugly for the same reason I chose, if we can go back to the early years of Ridley Scott, that episode.
Mm-hmm. That was a long time ago.
Yeah, just something that doesn't feel like it belongs in the director's body of work and is boring. And for that crime, I'm going to go with World Trade Center.
Oliver Stone directed yes. World Trade Center?
Yes.
I thought that was
I'm not over the Gabe, stop it. You're stealing my bit. I'm not of the overeducated belief, and that's the word I'll use, overeducated, that World Trade Center is a crude or dishonest movie.
It isn't.
I just think it's a really dreadfully dull one. We used to joke about how Lou Gossett or his fellow junior, Cuba Gooding, were the Oscar winners most regretted. Not in Nicolas Cage's America, baby. And, you know, if it weren't for Bottled Water Jesus, I would have been convinced this was, as Gabe said, a Ron Howard movie or a Phil Alvin Robinson movie or a movie of the week movie. It's just – I'm not going to say it's terrible, but not at all what you'd expect Oliver Stone to make.
I think
pretty terrible.
Fluffy. Schmaltzy. How many scenes can we show of Maria Bello crying?
If you go to IMDb, though, there's a video screen cap of Nick Cage screaming in a fireman's helmet that is awesome.
I'm looking at it right now.
His mustache looks really great.
A couple nights ago this week, I sat down and watched Machine Gun Preacher for reasons too dorky for me to possibly divulge to our listeners. And I couldn't help but notice Michael Shannon, the guy who played his junkie best friend. And then I realized that Michael Shannon was the Marine that I hated in World Trade Center.
I don't remember Michael Shannon in
Bag Doorknobs.
I don't remember him in World Trade Center.
Oh, he sees the attack on the news. He gets up and walks away from his desk at whatever job he is, goes to the barber, gets the jarhead haircut. You know, shave, goes home, throws open his deacon's bench, pulls out his uniform, and then walks to New York City from Bramblebuck, Virginia. Bench USA. He walks up to New York City with a flashlight and saves the day, only to turn face on the camera right at the end of the movie and say, "It's not over. Someone's going to pay for this."
Yeah, thanks for reminding me about that.
Yeah, and it's stuff like this. Whatever bit of enjoyment I got of it, because I'm one of the few people in the world who can enjoy is it pronounced Michael Pena?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm one of the few people in the world who can enjoy him. And I don't even mind Nicolas Cage too much in this movie, and I'm not a man who enjoys Nicolas Cage. But just every scene with that Marine, it just gets right under my skin. And I saw this movie in theaters, and it felt like it was 6 hours long.
I saw it, I think, when it was released on DVD, and I don't really hate it. I just, you know, like I said, this is an Oliver Stone movie, you know.
It's an anomaly.
Yeah, but I don't really consider it to be terrible. I think it's competently made and stuff. But it's just, you know, it's filmmaking for the lowest common denominator. You know.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and when you're talking about a director like Stone, that's what makes it ugly to me.
I found it hilarious when it was released and everybody was kind of like, "Where's the controversy?" and yada yada yada. And Stone was like,
"Single plane theory."
Well, no, he comes out and he basically says, you know, he was on Facebook, I believe, saying it, and, you know, just in a few interviews and stuff, like, where did I get this reputation as being a conspiracy nut? I don't understand. You know, I made JFK, yes, but, you know, like, all of a sudden he's this big conspiracy nut, and everybody's expecting every movie to be about conspiracies and all
that. The same place the Richard Gere rumor started.
What was the Richard Gere rumor?
Yes. You know, the gerbiling. Yeah.
Oh, man. I'm sorry I asked.
Gold, Jerry. Gold.
Oh, man. You know, World Trade Center is one of those movies, and there's a few of them in Stone's body of work that I just completely forget about. Mm-hmm. W is another one. Like, they're just utterly forgettable movies. Nixon is like that for me, and it's not a horrible movie, but it's just so goofy with him talking to himself, and it's Anthony Hopkins, and he doesn't really look like Nixon, and
no one looks like Nixon.
It's like, right? It's like my brain doesn't want to accept that Oliver Stone did this, so it just forgets about these movies.
It chooses to ignore it.
It's funny. Right. The best Nixons I've ever seen on camera are either Skeletor when they didn't do any makeup.
Frank Langella, yeah.
Yes.
Or the guy from Watchmen when they threw on so much makeup that it's ghoulish and ridiculous.
Yes.
And then there's Philip Baker Hall in the Robert Altman film, too. Secret Honor, I think? Yeah.
What I always loved about Nixon, though, is, you know, Hopkins makes the choice to portray him as a supervillain. And
yes.
It's amazing.
Oh, I think Hopkins is amazing in that movie.
I think Frank Langella is the better Nixon, though.
Yes.
Yeah, Frost Nixon was a great, great movie.
We're going to make those motherfuckers choke on our power and glory.
But before we lose the track of the rage train,
the rage train.
I'm going
to get on track or get out of the way.
I'm going to embark back and I'm going to bash Wall Street 2, Money Never Sleeps.
Yes, but that statement is true. Money does never sleep or does not ever sleep, however
that's
you want to say
that's
it.
Such
and
a
it's
great
absolutely true.
It's such a great action movie subtitle, you know, Wall Street right. 2, Wall Street Turner.
But, man, talk about messy and no idea what his message is. And just a complete and total mess of a movie.
The sequel no one was asking for.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I mean, like, basically, they overplayed the value of Gordon Gekko as a character in America. You know, like the popularity, the cult, whatever you want to call it. You know, they really certainly overestimated the appeal of that character. You know?
Well, I think it made bank still.
It did. Movie. Oh, yeah. It was a huge hit.
Yeah. Was that Gordon Gekko or Shia LaBeouf?
No.
It was actually decent in the movie. It was one of the better things about
this
movie.
It's one of two movies I've seen him in, the other being Lawless, where he actually gave a very earnest and convincing performance. You know?
And what about that one with David Morris as a serial killer? I fucking love that movie.
What, Eagle Eye? Or Disturbia?
No, not Eagle Eye, Disturbia. I just lost any credibility I ever had.
But also, in Wall Street 2, talk about, like, Stone propping up, like, stupid movie tricks for nothing and, like, showing, like, charts flowing on the screen and stuff and, like, he's trying to compensate for the nothing that is at the center of this movie by trickery. You know?
And that ending, man. That ending is just, ugh. When, you know, Gordon was a good guy all along, and, you know, it's just like, ugh.
Yeah, it's a pretty shitty movie. I mean, it's the only movie, Oliver Stone movie that I really dislike.
And now on the good side, it did get Josh Brolin a paycheck.
Fair enough.
Because I enjoy most of his movies, but not Wall Street 2.
I just, you know, I've Wall Street 2 for me was the same as World Trade Center. It was just so inauspicious and completely unambitious that, you know, it didn't even register on my radar.
Mm-hmm.
I watched it and forgot it.
I thought it was an April Fool's joke.
Yeah, it's a baffling – watching that movie is, even as somebody who does not like Wall Street, is a baffling experience. It's like if Kubrick had directed 2010 – I watched that, and it's like, seriously?
I love 2010.
Wasn't it your good
I
on
have
the Himes
a
episode?
Somewhat of a soft spot for it, but it's so
different.
Everything that 2001 is not.
Yeah, it's a very different film.
Like if Kubrick had directed that, we would all have been scratching our heads, like, what happened here?
Imagine if Kubrick had directed Wall Street 2.
That would be fantastic. There'd be a lot more nudity in
it. What happened here, Stan? I got into the tasty bubbles.
I drank champagne out of a football helmet.
I went to the desert and I ate some mushrooms.
The Gordon Gekko and a bunch of naked women in masks.
Jesus. I want to see that movie.
Murders.
Yeah. You'll know why they call me the Lizard King.
Oh.
All right.
You know, yeah, and it would have to be shot like The Doors, too, with all the weird filters and everything.
That wasn't Kubrick.
And Indians having car accidents.
Yeah, there would have to be Indians having car accidents.
Alright, with that out of the way, let's go on our final thoughts about Oliver Stone. Dan?
You know, obviously great filmmaker, great technician, impassioned, and I mean, that's what you have to kind of dig about him. Whether you like an individual movie or not, it's, aside from the two that we've just talked about, there are Oliver Stone movies. It's kind of, can we throw in something about JFK at this point?
Yeah, sure.
I feel like we can't, you know, we can't do a podcast on Oliver Stone and not talk about JFK, can we?
No. We should.
And that one would have been, you know, had I picked it, probably a bad for me, but still what a brilliantly constructed, yes, insane movie. But still a ton of fun, and
I don't know, I just love that scene deeply.
But I felt like it needed to be mentioned. You know, like that's a pretty big piece of his body of work,
his legacy. I think with JFK kind of transcends between good and bad for me. You know, like I consider it more good than bad, and you know it's easy to get caught up in all the conspiracy nut hoopla that followed it, but I mean. There's a reason why the movie was nominated for so many awards that year and was such a critical darling and made so many best of the year lists, you know. It was a phenomenal piece of filmmaking. Costner nailed it. You had so many memorable sequences that were just so, like, exquisitely constructed. Again, not a subtle movie, but no. Oliver Stone does not know the meaning of the word subtle. You know, it's just not in his vocabulary. But, so much stuff in that movie just works so well. Like the scene, you know, it's been lampooned so many times since. I believe Chris Carter even kind of considered it one of his big inspirations for The X-Files was the scene in front of the Washington Memorial or Washington Monument or something, you know, that the informant scene, you know, this goes all the way up to the highest corridors of power. And, you know, like that
follow the money in.
Yeah. Like that sequence was just so incredible.
You're asking the wrong questions.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's a nutty movie in terms of its content, but the way that he puts it together and the fact that it – I don't remember how long it is, but it's long.
I think it's about
it's a really well-paced movie, especially for something where there's a lot of just characters talking.
A lot of procedural.
A lot of procedural, and it's one of those things where, you know, you watch it, and at least when I watch it, I think there's not many directors who could do this as well. Fincher is probably the only one working today who could pull off that kind of movie and keep it that engrossing and that engaging and fast-paced when it's a lot of complex business and characters talking to each other.
And there are certainly elements of it that remind me of Zodiac, just in how it's constructed, how it's filmed, you know? Like, there are definitely certain elements of it that definitely hearken, you know? Great movie. But, I mean, that's the thing with Stone, too, is, you know, I mean, like you said, technically brilliant. And what I love about him, what really makes him, you know, one of my top five, you know, when I have a list of my own favorite directors, he's in my top five consistently. And the reason for it is the guy is just so earnest. You know, like, he really does, for the most part, like, you know, just about everything he's done outside of maybe Wall Street 2 and World Trade Center, he really believes in what he's shooting. You know, like, he really believes in what he's putting together. He's an earnest filmmaker. You know, what he sees and what he films is an absolute truth in his mind. You know, whether he's right or not is entirely debatable and at the end entirely irrelevant. You know, it's a situation where he makes what he considers to be an absolute truth, and either you're on board or you're not. You know, it's not a situation of, like, it's not open for debate. JFK is not open for discussion. He's not trying to open up a book and have people discuss what really happened. He's trying to tell you what could be a literal truth. You know, like, if you take the movie at face value, this is what happened. It was this conspiracy. This is what happened to JFK, you know, and there is some truth in that. I mean, people still don't entirely know. Was it just one deranged Marine? Who knows? We don't know. But, like, the thing is, it's not trying to question it. It's not trying to get you to debate it or think, oh, maybe what you're looking at is wrong. It's telling you, hey, this is what I think happened. You know, this is in Oliver Stone's mind, and I can't remember the name of the author.
It's Jim Garrison.
Jim Garrison. Yeah, I think it was Garrison, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, I mean, you know, this is what they perceive as truth. This is the true story behind the JFK assassination, you know?
And even if you don't take that point of view, you could say, like, this is something that could have happened.
Yeah,
you know?
But he doesn't even want you to debate that. He wants you to see that, and this is his literal truth. This is Oliver Stone's, you know, this is what happened, you know? It's not open.
Right, which is the source of his, you know, why did I become the conspiracy guy? And it's that.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, because most people are like, no, the former Marine shot him in the head is what happened.
Yeah.
But the other point I would make about Stone that I really appreciate, even in the films that I don't care for as much, is, you know, we now live in a world where Hollywood is – bending over backwards to appeal to markets everywhere.
It's just true.
And they're just dumbing everything down
and
making everything big and loud and stupid so that films transcend language and culture and everything else. And, hey, let's throw a Chinese character in there because, you know, that's a huge market over there and, you know, that sort of stuff. Let's edit this movie in a different way for the Chinese audience and that sort of thing, which is fine. At a certain level, but it also creates a kind of homogenized, inartful product. And Stone is one of the last directors standing who is quintessentially American.
Oh, yeah.
And
everything that he does is about the experience of being an American. And it's not dumbed down. It's not created for some international audience. It is, you know, directly from his heart, whether you agree with it or not. It's his experience of America.
So you're watching Oliver Stone. You're free base in the red, white, and blue.
Basically.
Mainline in Stars and Stripes.
And the thing that I will add is that he is obviously in love with the whole filmmaking aspect. You know, the care that he takes to give, like, each of his movies a certain tone. Even those that don't work, they have a different look and a different feel. And he really seems to enjoy the process, and, you know, most of his movies, they feel alive.
Yeah, and they, I mean, even for as much as I don't like, you know, Natural Born Killers, you've got U-Turn, which is a similar formula perfected. You know, like, everything he does has just got this earnestness about it. Even MBK, you know, no, I don't like the movie, but I can clearly see what he was going for, you know?
And that's where his importance kind of stands, you know, as this guy, whatever happens. I mean, this guy has won Oscars. He could just be complacent and do prestige pictures, but he continues to, like, tread his own way.
Savages was definitely not a prestige picture.
No. And you wouldn't see Spielberg doing Any Given Sunday.
No,
you
know? No. And I will say Savages was actually pretty cool. You know.
I have to say, I do sort of wish that Stone had directed Lincoln.
That would have been interesting. Have been
I don't amazing. Know how many shooters there would have been. But
John, do you have anything to say about Stone?
Yeah, he should never wear a mustache again. The picture That's on true. His Wikipedia page is terrifying. I definitely like his earlier work more than his later work. I kind of feel he... I won't say he peaked because it's not his best movie, but Stone to me really, you know, I haven't seen Savages yet. He stopped being as interesting to me after U-Turn.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
But I do like him, and I like the fact that Oliver Stone agrees with me in the fact that after seeing the poster and the trailer for Savages, that ballistic masks are totally awesome. But yeah, no, just he's a very, very interesting filmmaker.
I think U-Turn exhausted all the nihilistic despair he had left in him, and he kind of...
Well, dude, once you've written and directed TNT, where else do you have to go?
When TNT goes off, somebody's career gets hurt.
But yeah, very interesting filmmaker. You know, if you haven't seen it, like, up to last week, I had never seen Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't seen Oliver Stone, there is a wealth of watchable movies there, interesting movies.
And don't let yourself be fooled by the conspiracy nut.
It was one movie.
Or the natural born killer's craziness. You know, Oliver Stone has a large palette that he uses.
And actually, I kind of like that about him is that he does switch it up so often. I mean, would you expect the director of Platoon to be the director of Wall Street?
No.
Or the director of Wall Street to be the director of Natural Born Killers? Or the director of Natural Born Killers to be the director of Nixon, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or the director of World Trade Center not to be Ron Howard.
Stone is a chimera. You know, and it's just, he's a really, really interesting cat to watch.
All right. With that said, Steve, you're next. Who's our pick for next?
Oh, be sure to tune in next time because it's bound to be a doozy. We are going to be taking on or going head-to-head with or button horns with or otherwise using aggressive combat speech on the life and times of Mr. Stanley Kubrick.
And the guys will have to shut me up because... the podcast. So
Quebecois dominance next week.
Before we finish, I would like to thank our guest Dan Mancini.
Yeah,
for joining
for
us this week.
Yeah, Dan, you got to pop around more often, man. This is a good show.
Yeah, I'll definitely do so.
And see you next Wednesday.